Stoicism, the highly practical ancient Greek philosophy. It's a philosophy that is meant to be put into action and is not designed for those who prefer to stay on the armchair. Founded in Athens in the early 3rd century BC, it has captivated minds throughout history and recently has experienced a revival. In 2013, Forbes magazine stated that modern Stoic thought holds fascinating promise for business and government leaders tackling global problems. Thanks to the likes of Christopher Gill, Donald Robinson, and Massimo Pigliucci, all former guests on this podcast, the modern Stoic movement has discovered itself. We have found the others. However, a question remains. How should Stoics practice? This answer has not been decidedly settled. And at this year's Stoicon X conference here in Toronto, the largest Stoic community in the world is hosting a conference on practice. I think this conference will play an important part in the development of shared practices for Stoicism. It could be the first step towards modern Stoic thought becoming collectively embodied. Donald Robinson, Massimo Pigliucci, Chuck Chakrapani, and Toronto's own John Vervaeke will be all speakers there. So if you're interested in coming out, the early bird tickets are still on sale. They can be purchased at www.thestoa.ca. Okay, welcome back to the Intellectual Explorers podcast. I'm recording outside right now because it's so freaking nice out here. So you might see or hear birds chirping, cars going by, and neighbors speaking in languages I don't understand. So some housekeeping before we begin. I'm switching up my approach to this podcast. I'm sort of resistant to treating this like other podcasts where I have to post an episode every Monday or something like that. Instead, I'm going to be a little bit more random with the output. So whenever the daemon strikes, I will go on an exploration and release an episode then. And I don't know when this is going to be. It might be an episode once every 3 months or maybe 3 times a week. Let's see what emerges. Also, some of the stuff about this podcast is pretty lo-fi. I currently like keeping things this way. It makes it intimate, at least for me. And I'm not aggressively trying to grow this podcast or my in-person club. So I'm viewing this as insider baseball for those playing in the sense-making web already. And if you have any comments about this or the podcast in general, best way to reach out to me is to DM me on Twitter. My handle is Peter M. Lindbergh. So for today's episode, I had an exploration with Gabriel Weinberg. He is the founder and CEO of DuckDuckGo, which is the only browser I use. It is created to protect searchers' privacy, and I highly recommend pivoting to it if you have not done so already. Gabriel is also the author of the new book called Superthinking, the Big Book of Mental Models, which is a book that contains over 300 plus mental models that you can use right away. I really appreciate and enjoy the whole mental model strategy. I use it myself. The basic idea is to have a slew of mental models at the ready that you put to memory that you can use when navigating life. We reviewed some of the mental models in this podcast, but definitely check out the book at your nearest bookstore. All right, enjoy this exploration I had with Gabriel. Today, I'm exploring with Gabriel Weinberg. Before we begin, I'm going to anchor myself in an exploratory mindset. My intention is to engage in this dialogue with the spirit of exploration. I'm not here to agree or disagree, but to be a performative agnostic and understand my interlocutor's map of reality and possibly explore new territory together. That being said, Gabriel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you recently released this book called Super Thinking, the Big Book of Mental Models, where you talk about like over 300 mental models. And I'm sure a good chunk of my listeners are familiar with what mental models are, but you also introduced a term I quite like called supermodels. So maybe you can briefly describe what a mental model is for those who do not know, and maybe kind of explore what makes a mental model super.
Sure. So a mental model is really just a fancier or a longer word or two words for a concept. And so, you know, there's concepts everywhere in every field. And so I was actually a physics major. And so, you know, as people who did physics in high school and earlier school know, you learn lots of different physics concepts as you learn physics, but they're generally just useful for physics, right? Mm-hmm. But those are the mental models of physics. But then there are these some of these mental models, which we're calling supermodels, which are generally useful beyond the discipline. So in physics, an example is critical mass. And so critical mass is this physics concept that help in atomic reactions. But as people know, you know, a product, a party, a political movement can have critical mass. And that as a metaphor, it helps you really understand how those things might unfold. In particular, for critical mass, it's like once you reach a threshold amount, you start to get this kind of snowball effect and a kind of runaway chain reaction. And so there are many of these so-called supermodels that come from different disciplines and that are generally useful for like understanding the world, making decisions, truth seeking, if you will. I set out originally to make a list of them and came up with about 300. And that's really what the book is about, listing all and explaining all these.
And I'd like to get into some individual mental models, but were these, when you were like collecting them, were you like field testing them first? So these are the ones that, you know, worked in my life, or were you just kind of collecting ones that you saw other people use and like sort of other communities that are doing the same thing?
So I came onto this whole kind of mental models area a long time ago, like 20 years ago, from a lot of people, from Charlie Munger first, and then through the behavioral psychology and economics area, initially from reading Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely.
Right.
And so I had come across this nice concept, and then I kind of went looking for them over these last 20 years. Mm. And making a list even. And so the original list came from myself, really just writing them down and the ones that I use personally. And so I actually published this list in 2016. And the reason why I published it actually is I realized that knowing these supermodels are just really good for making decisions. And when you're making a lot of decisions, or someone who makes a lot of decisions is a company executive like myself. And I wanted to train the rest of our executives and generally their whole team to make better decisions, because at the company that I work and run, we try to empower kind of everyone to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write down this list to be like, these are the things you should go learn. And so that was the genesis of writing it all down. But yeah, it really originally came from me. And then when I started to, you know, research and put out the list, I also like read everything I could on each topic. And so I got to adjacent topics as well. Hmm.
And do you have sort of like a mental model that manages what mental models you use?
You know, it's funny, like, I ended up with this book, which is part of the reason why I end up writing it and a co-author with my wife on it, is because Charlie Munger has a famous quote that's like 80 to 90 models will make you worldly wise. Right. No one ever wrote down what the models are. And I wanted to really be systematic and make a survey of it. But the book I actually wanted to write before I did that, was something called, which I never did write, is like a almost a tactical guide to problem solving, where it was that framework where you'd have almost like a flow chart or a map. And I attempted that several times and failed every time. And so my short answer is no. And I have tried to learn these concepts so well that they basically are pattern matched across the current situation. And like this kind of feels like that. And occasionally I'll look through a list. But I do think, to your point, there probably is a better tool out there. I just haven't come across it yet.
And do you have, I'm curious, do you have like a life stance, or, you know, what they call a Weltanschauung, or like a kind of a core operating system, whether it's like Christianity or Buddhism? Like I'm big on Stoicism. Do you have something like that that kind of maybe gives purpose to all these mental models?
Not in terms of necessarily buying in or like being part of a movement, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But there's a mental model in there, you know, called the North Star, which is effectively a mission statement. You know, the North Star is the star in the sky, actually Polaris, that points north, or is, you know, oriented towards basically north. So you kind of know you're headed in the right direction.
Right.
And so as a metaphor or mental model, it's like, what is your company mission or vision or personal mission or vision? So you know that like you're heading in the right direction. So for me, I did kind of identify that, 10 years or so ago, or maybe at 15, as make kind of maximize my unique positive contribution to the world. Hmm. And so I do try to do things that are aligned with that. And each word kind of is important to me. So like, for example, unique, I one of the reasons I didn't really go into physics, I didn't feel like I could necessarily make a unique contribution. Mm-hmm. And so I'm attracted to things that, like, if I didn't do it, you know, nobody else would probably do it right now. And because then I feel like I'm making more of a difference there. So that's kind of the closest thing I have to what you're saying.
Right. Because, like, you know, you're also the CEO and founder of DuckDuckGo. And I highly recommend everyone use that, because that's my browser of choice at the moment. And then you're writing these books, these mental model books, and you write other things. And so you would say that the North Star that unites those projects and maybe the other projects that you're working on is that kind of maximizing your unique contribution to the world?
Yeah, unique positive contribution. And, you know, in this mental model case, I feel, no one else was necessarily doing it in this way. And I thought it would be really useful for everyone to have it. I mean, it's a lot of work to turn the list into a book. So without that reasoning, I probably wouldn't have done it. But yeah, that's the motivation and thread between these things.
Mm-hmm. And do you have like a sense of like a spectrum between like how super a model can get, meaning how, like, how much it is like applicable across all domains, and how much the domains get narrowed the more specific the model is?
Yeah, in the original list I posted, which is effectively a blog post on Medium, I actually tried to score them about on the realm of effectively how frequently I use them. You know, so the ones that are more frequently used are, you know, not necessarily more widely applicable, but they're at least more frequently applicable. After writing the book, I definitely think there are a handful, and a lot of these mental models are interrelated, right? So
yeah.
The book, while it sounds like there's so many, there's really 9 themes and 9 chapters, and a lot of them kind of move around the same general concept. And so there's a few of these that are, I would, yeah, call like, I don't know what the right term is, ultra super, meta super. and so like things like opportunity cost, leverage, forcing functions, I'd put in that category. That kind of comes up all the time everywhere.
Right, right. And like, I've been experimenting with mental models myself, and there's sort of like, you know, once you grok it, once you get to a certain point of understanding, it almost like becomes intuitive, like when a life moment happens and it gets triggered. So you almost don't have to use too much, what they call system 2 thinking, at least I find.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's kind of what I was trying to say earlier, just in a really long-winded way. It's like, that's ultimately how they've been internalized. If you use them a lot with system 2 thinking, they'll become intuitive. You still have to like check to see whether it's right, and then it's kind of delve in back into the system 2 thinking. But yeah, they if you're kind of doing it for a long time, they just kind of pop in your head, you know?
Right, right. And so for someone who's not familiar with mental models, or they don't use this approach, I guess I have 2 questions here. One of them is, what would you recommend for them to kind of install this kind of technology beyond just reading your book?
Yeah, I recommend, so there's a lot of ways to do this, but you basically have to practice. I mean, one of the models in the book is deliberate practice. And so it's kind of the best way to jump up a learning curve on something. And so you really need to find a space to practice. There are a number of ways to do that. You know, one thing that I've been lucky to have is my wife, who wrote the book with me, and we kind of like walk every morning, which was written in the book, and talk about, you know, current events and company stuff and life stuff. And, you know, in the context of these mental models, trying to explain, you know, what's going on. And so like having someone to kind of talk through things on a regular basis and trying to get to like the root cause of things, even on a daily basis, I think is probably the best way to do that. Like if you don't have a particular person that goes across your entire life, I think you could cut that up, you know, find someone at your company to talk about what's going on, company stuff, talk to someone about, you know, political stuff, that kind of thing, spread it around. I think you could do it online, online forums, you know, can do that decently well. Another approach that somebody told me a long time ago is like, you know, read the op-ed pages or read the opinion pages of big newspapers and kind of internalize what the arguments they're making and how and why they're kind of good or bad and kind of what mental models they're using. That's a good way to do it as well.
That resonates, because back in my I took philosophy in university, and kind of in the critical thinking courses, they make you read articles, opinion pieces, and you got to like fallacy spot in the wild, so to speak.
Exactly.
And then, you know, one thing I was trying to do, I didn't end up doing it, but I wanted to create an Anki deck. You know, you're familiar with the Anki technology?
No, please tell me.
It's like, it's basically like those space repetition cue cards.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you want to memorize something, but there's like an app for it, and they give you it at certain intervals to help you memorize it better. So I wanted to create like a whole deck of all 300 models so I could release it with the episode. I don't think that's too ambitious of a project.
That is ambitious, but that would be cool.
something like that would be, yeah. And I got the whole, like, I'm curious if how familiar you are with the applied rationality, like Less Wrong community, because that was the chapter of your first the book.
I know of the site, if that's what you're referring to. I'm not, I haven't spent a lot of time there. But yeah, I mean, I agree with the philosophy, if it is what I think it is. Which is trying to be less wrong, because that being wrong less is the title of the first chapter.
I want to dive into the individual models, but I'm just curious, who's kind of your like intellectual influences? Do you have anybody you keep returning to? Do you have any campsites or websites that you like to visit?
I still am a pretty frequent visitor of Hacker News. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. It started out and kind of the startup community, Hacker being like a startup company hacker kind of type. But they routinely have, you know, interesting discussions on the site. You know, at different points, I had been reading Slashdot and, you know, what was that site that's like the Meta one that I'm forgetting, it was a number of years ago. In any case, not really. I mean, I read a lot off of kind of deeper news items, you know, thought pieces type of thing. But in terms of like repeat things, I'd say more that like, you know, the Dan Ariely stuff is probably the closest, and the Charlie Munger is the closest thing to that.
Right. So like something that has a practical edge to it.
Yeah. I mean, I did delve into the philosophical edges 20 years ago, but I haven't really done that much since.
Yeah, because once you get, you know, the metasphere, if you want to call it that, then you start floating away. You might not return if you're not grounded.
Yeah, no, I did that, but it was just a long time ago.
Right. When you could afford to do it.
Yeah, exactly. When I, you know, late teens, early 20s.
Right. So what mental models would you recommend someone to start out with first?
So one that after writing this book, I really got to thinking about this question. One that I like a lot and come back to is this concept of forcing function. And it is the idea that you can force yourself or others to kind of do something, usually think critically would be the best use of it, by effectively scheduling default time to do so into your calendar. So for example, at DuckDuckGo, you know, our company, we have postmortems, kickoff calls at every for every project that happens with a kind of a set agenda that helps us think critically about like what do we really want to accomplish in this project, and then was it really accomplished and why, and how can we do better? Similarly, at the beginning of each week, we kind of have a forcing function called top priorities where we're figuring out what the real top priority is for everybody that week. Mm-hmm. So we're always working on the best top of mind thing. Mm-hmm. In a personal context, you know, like I mentioned, walking with my wife every morning, that's a forcing function for us to kind of get intellectually stronger and also get a closer in relationship. It could be just your scheduling time to go to the gym, you know? And it's combining a few different models, like the default effect, which is you don't change defaults very often. So you want your defaults to matter, a commitment, which is another mental model. And so it's combining these things, but I like that mental model, like meta one of the forcing function.
Right. And what would be your, maybe it's your favorite as well, but what would be your personal favorite one, one that you kind of geek out over?
Yeah, that it might be one of the same, but I kind of geek out productivity wise on this concept of high leverage activities,
right.
Which is kind of in this more meta concept of leverage. But it's the idea that, you know, when you start doing a lot of things, you're if you're lucky to not be constrained as much in other ways, your time becomes your most finite resource, right? And if you want to accomplish lots of amazing things, you know, you have to apply that really carefully. And what it comes down to is thinking about what are the highest leverage things you can be spending your time on. And it's often not an easy question. And it brings in that other concept I mentioned earlier of opportunity costs, which is, you know, if you have a decision in front of you, you're not just evaluating like whether to do that or not. You're also evaluating what else you could do with your time if you did or did not do that. Mm-hmm. And so trying to figure out like what are the highest leverage activities for you to work on, or if you're an organization, what everyone else should work on, I think is one that I am constantly like coming back to.
Right. Because that one is like, if you master that one, then you master a lot of other things.
Exactly. And a high leverage activity is learning mental models, for an example.
Right. Right.
And you know, as soon as you have an organization, it's often making your organization more efficient. And so like a lot of people miss that because like if you're building a product or something, it feels like you should be focused on that product. But if you already have, you know, 50 people working at your company, you know, if you can make them better at building the product, that's probably better than you working on it yourself most of the time. And so it kind of, it gets meta quickly, but focusing on whatever people around you to focus them and yourself on high leverage activities is really powerful.
Right. And that kind of, circling in the or looping in the DuckDuckGo and your kind of responsibilities there, I imagine like once you started that, all these moving parts started, you know, happening in your life that you had to manage. And so did you start more consciously applying mental models when DuckDuckGo started, or is this something you always kind of had in the back of your mind?
You know, it's something that I started working on and with well before that. Cause I basically started companies right out of school. Mm. And so it was about, you know, 8 years or before that, you know, before starting DuckDuckGo. Mm-hmm. And have been kind of slowly learning to apply these since. And so it's like, it makes me not be able to necessarily give great advice to starting out. I'm trying to.
Right.
It's hard for me to like put myself back in that original position, which is another mental model, veil of ignorance, you know, trying to think about what it's like to be in other people's shoes. Mm. But it's hard for me to emotionally do that. And it might be the case that I'm also just like predisposed to think like this. Mm-hmm. But so in terms of your question, no, I was well into this after starting DuckDuckGo.
Right. And, you know, this Robert Hansen, he has this, I guess it's a mental model called Viewquakes, where like you come across a new idea and you just kind of like your whole map of reality just gets transformed from it. And you're like, you almost get like a high with it. It's like you get a giddy, like, yes.
Yes.
Any particular mental models upon discovering, you're like, oh my God, thank you, you know, for like being introduced to this.
Yeah. So yeah, some real epiphany moments.
Yeah.
Definitely. So there's a whole chapter around, you know, it's called Unlocking People's Potential. And it's effectively about that and how to manage people effectively. And a big epiphany moment for me was realizing that there is no one size fits all management that works. And if you want to get the most unlocking people's potential, you have to treat people very individually and understand their kind of differences and skills and desires and goals and roles and everything. And then kind of arrange them to almost like make roles that enable them to be ultra successful. And if you can do that, and we walk this pretty detail, you can kind of construct these what we call 10x teams, where you're getting amazing output out of people because it's just like this perfect alignment. And there's another mental model from physics that is referenced here called resonant frequency, which is, you know, like when you play the right note, a glass breaks. And that's because it's just exactly the right energy that just amplifies itself. And that could be the same with kind of people and getting that exact right kind of project fit for them.
Right, right.
That one really opened my eyes.
Huh. Any others?
Yeah, I mean, there's almost in each meta concept, there was probably one there in the last chapter, which is about, it's called Flexing Your Market Power. And it's about, effectively, you know, maximizing your chances for outside success, both personally, or if you're starting a business. And there's a very simple concept in there, called the consensus contrarian matrix. And it's basically a 2x2 matrix with, whether something is consensus or not on, on one side, and whether you're right or wrong on the other side. And basically what it says is, if you are right in what you think you're doing, whether that's like an investment or a startup idea or a career decision, but it's consensus, meaning lots of people believe that, you know, you can have success for certain, but you're not likely to have outside success because, you know, everyone else is doing that. And so the only way to get kind of outside success is to be both contrarian and right. Mm-hmm. And not that everyone's shooting for that kind of, you know, success or impact. But for me personally, you know, trying to maximize an outsized positive impact, maximize a positive impact, like that was very attractive to me and eye-opening, because it means that you kind of have to do something other people aren't, you know, to be unique, right, and to be contrarian and to make a bigger impact. So that was a big one for me.
Nice, nice. So how about I just throw out some mental models and then the ones that you list in your book, and then maybe we can just talk about them.
Sure.
Yeah. This is also a test. Do you actually know all 300? Okay. So the,
risky, you know?
Yeah.
Cause I am a co-author too. So some of them were not as mine, you know?
But so yeah. So foxes and hedgehogs.
Oh yeah. So this gets to the thing we were just talking earlier about, like, people are different. And so there's a lot of ways people are different, you know, like personality-wise, introverts, extroverts. Fox and hedgehogs is another one of those kind of dichotomies, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's whether you're kind of it's almost like a generalist or specialist notion, whether you kind of have one big idea that you kind of centralize all your thinking around, versus you're much more, you know, nuanced, and you're willing to kind of not to commit to things all around. And that's kind of the fox and hedgehog distinction. And what's interesting is, like, I think a lot of people look at these and they're like, well, one's better than the other. But what we tried to say in the book and explain, especially this one, is, like, there are great leaders in different situations who have both of these tendencies, and you want probably all these different types of people at your organization, but you want to put them in roles that are more suited for them.
Right. And I imagine that, like, individually during certain phases in your life, and maybe even during the same phase, but different domains, you might want to be more of a fox or more of a hedgehog.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, like, so this concept of the hedgehog, where you're like, we referenced this book, Jim Collins' famous book, Good to Great, where he profiles these kind of great companies who took off. And one of the things he says is, well, they had all these, what he calls hedgehog concepts, where it's like the one big concept that everyone can rally around, you know, and buy into this vision. And that is really good when, you know, you can just take a vision and it's correct and you move forward and all you have to do is just get people to buy into it. The opposite scenario is when, you know, all hell's breaking loose and things are very complicated and nuanced and you need an intense strategic decision. And then if you stick to one vision, you could just be wrong because maybe it was the thing that worked in the past that no longer works today. And a lot of those companies actually profiled, you know, ultimately you basically fell apart or stopped being great when that concept kind of ran out of gas, you know, the world changed and got disrupted. And so you need definitely both types of thinking at different points in a life cycle.
Right, right. So here's the next one, OODA loop.
Oh yeah. So it's pretty interesting. That one, called the OODA loop, like I actually came onto pretty late. And so this is a concept from fighter pilots basically. And it's a fascinating story that like, this gentleman, I'm forgetting his name and if I have him in front of you.
John Boyd, is that the...
Yeah, yeah. I want to credit the people who made him if I could. But it's one thing to remember everything. It's remember to remember everyone's name, you know?
Right.
So he was like a fighter pilot trainer. And he... And basically these fighter pilots would go up in fake dogfights and try to test their different strategies. And everyone had like a different strategy of what they're going to do in a dogfight. And then he came up with this meta strategy called the OODA loop, where you actually don't have a strategy. You go up and you just do this continuous loop as fast as you can, orient, observe, decide, act, where you kind of look around, you make sure you're looking at the right things, you observe what's going on, you make a quick decision, and then you immediately do it. And he training pilots to do this OODA loop instead of a predefined kind of playbook actually like won out like an amazing percentage of time in these dogfights. And as a metaphor, it really applies well in situations where there's a lot of uncertainty, like in a dogfight, like especially like in technology startups, where instead of just predefining your plan for the next 2 years and marching around that plan, you can't really do that because, you know, things are changing all the time and other companies are competing with you. And you do much better if you have these tight OODA loops. And almost like if you can get your company to, or not almost, it's true, if you can get your company to have these really fast innovation loops, that can be your like sustainable competitive advantage. And so it's a really powerful concept.
Right. Kind of reminds me of improv, like acting.
Yeah.
Like that's script.
A great example.
Yeah, like kind of like being tethered to a script and you have to memorize it and all that stuff versus kind of like just having a threshold of skill sets, like of acting skill sets, and then kind of letting it go and running that algorithm.
That's right. And that's what it really feels to run a fast-paced startup, to be honest.
Right, right. Okay, so this one I like is radical candor.
Yeah, this is back in the people management idea. And effectively, it's like, there's kind of two things you're doing with people management. One is putting people in the right positions to succeed, and then also trying to grow them, right? And to grow people, you kind of want to help them engage in deliberate practice, which is this notion that I referenced earlier of helping people learn new skills by putting them kind of right outside their comfort zone and having them work on that skill while you're giving them real-time feedback of how they can improve. Very hard to do in practice because it's taxing psychologically, and so you have to work, like, watch out for these other mental models like imposter syndrome and Dunning-Kruger effect, etc. But radical candor is the nicest or best way to kind of give feedback in that process. And what it's basically saying is, radical in this context is like getting to the root of the issue, the radical of the issue, but it's saying don't sugarcoat anything and try to give people direct and actionable feedback. So it's not too vague, and you know, you have to be pretty close to them as well so they trust you in this process. And it's usually like a mentor or something like that. But if you can give people this quick and you know, really actionable feedback, they can grow really quickly.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying. You had a 2x2 somewhere in the book. I'm trying to look for it.
Oh yeah. So that's the next layer deep. You know, in these things, I was like, I hesitate to explain the 2x2s because the visual's not in front of us. You
right,
know?
right.
But yeah, there's a 2x2 about how specific versus vague your feedback is, and whether you are perceived as caring about that person or not, like you're kind of have a close relationship, and you want to be specific and in the caring quadrant, because if you're in any other quadrant, it just doesn't work. Like if you're too vague, people don't know what to do with your feedback. And if you don't really care about them, it's too easy for them to like just rationalize away as like, oh, that person's, you know, he's just got, or she got other motivations, you know?
Yeah. I like that. And it's almost like allowing the person to save face when you're like caring personally about them, but you're challenging them directly at the same time.
Exactly.
So maybe we'll do a couple of more. How about systems thinking?
Oh yeah. That back to your epiphany question, that's probably another one. I mean, this actually came, I have a graduate degree in from the technology and policy program from MIT. And it was, if there was one concept that was the point of the program, it was systems thinking. and then even more of that, like I also like had a RA-ship from a person who wrote books on this topic. So I was like doubly into it and then wrote my thesis about it, or at least applied. And so systems thinking is like, you know, not just looking at one part or effect of something, but the overall system of something and understanding how all the different things interplay. So like, if you want to say, like, think about the weather and predict the weather, it's very hard to do that. But if you can predict, say, the climate and look at the overall climate and all the jet stream and things like going on, then you can get a much more deeper understanding about how things might change or even be able to predict the weather a little better. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the difference. And now actually doing systems thinking is quite complicated because you have to kind of map out the system. And there are a lot of different tools to do that, some of which we kind of talk about. But it's that as a metaphor and a mental model, it's always trying to take almost a step back and really think, is this kind of part of a bigger system? Let's think about like how this interplays into that.
Right. And something came to mind, not only like system thinking in a descriptive way, but in like a proactive way. What comes to mind is that Scott Adams quote, provocatively, goals are for losers, systems are for winners type thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's also true. That's another good way to apply it.
So how about divergent and lateral thinking?
So, you know, there's different ways of kind of brainstorming and things like that. And this actually comes up a lot practically, at least it's at DuckDuckGo, because when you're coming up with new ideas a lot, you want to like do a lot of brainstorming, right? Mm-hmm. But it turns out most people do brainstorming wrong or suboptimally. Mm-hmm. And the most common way is like everyone gets in a room and we're like, we're going to brainstorm now. The problem with that is it gets into a bunch of kind of fallacy traps like groupthink, where as soon as someone comes up with an idea, then like the group is headed in that direction. And then like kind of other ideas get more off the table, even unintentionally. And so the concept that kind of, you know, helps with this, or the concepts are divergent and lateral thinking. Divergent being that you want almost the ideas and brainstorming to diverge in different directions before you converge them on like the thing that you decide. And the way to effectuate this initially with brainstorming, at least, is you get together the group first and say, we're going to go brainstorm, but I'm going to send you off individually to brainstorm, or even in groups of two, or small groups, and then come back and then talk about all the ideas and then maybe be convergent. So you have much more diversity in the initial idea set. And then lateral thinking is more like, it's almost a tactical ideas and techniques for when you're actually doing that process. So if you have an idea, almost like throwing randomness into your brainstorming process. Like one of the things that people do is like, they just open a page in a book and just read out words and say like, how can that be related to our, what we're talking about here? Mm-hmm. And that kind of thinking can just like jolt you out of your kind of current rut, if you will, like psychological, like where you are, and maybe spark some new ideas.
Right, right. Idea sex is, I like that term.
Yeah.
So, maybe we can end off on like a really sexy one. Do you have any ones come to mind that you think?
Oh, I thought you might have something in mind there.
I'm just kind of thinking, any ones that, I could propose one, but do you have any one that's like really kind of juicy to leave off in?
Juicy. That's an interesting way to put it.
One that we can squeeze in a lot of good out of it.
I don't know. There's a whole chapter on basically statistics and statistical models, and they're kind of hard to talk about. But my wife's a statistician, so she was the point person to start writing about this stuff. But I find people gloss over them too much, so I like to highlight it, you know? And the basic idea is that don't throw away all statistics, even though it does seem like you can use it to make any argument. But like, your goal is to understand the statistical model so you can actually figure out what is kind of the good study versus the bad study. And one thing that's probably the most common bias that arises in that whole area is this concept of selection bias, where if you're kind of looking at a study or running a survey or any kind of experiment yourself, and you want to make a judgment about like a population, you got to make sure that the group that you're actually surveying is representative of the full population, which in the vast majority of cases it isn't. And then if it's not, you have to like think about what bias that's introducing.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I think that it was sufficiently juicy, that one.
Fair enough.
So yeah, I recommend everyone check out Super Thinking, the big book of mental models. The copy I have is pretty big. You can also use it as a weapon to throw it at people if, you know, if you're not reading it. But, and I also like to kind of throw that out there. If anybody wants to help out doing the Anki deck and all these models, that'd be pretty cool to help people learn them in a quick and fun way. So Gabriel, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. That was a fun exploration.
Thank you again.
All right, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring. Boom.